This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have one of our somewhat busy mornings today. So I hope I won't talk too long, and we can do full moon ceremony, and then we have our you should pardon the expression parish council meeting afterwards. I wanted just to say a couple of things about teaching or teacher, student, this sort of thing, which is sometimes, I think, confusing to people a little bit. And as I was pondering that, I was reminded that someone who used to live here was at talk I was giving, I think it was anyway, and I said that I didn't particularly have anything special to teach. And later this person told me that she was very pleased to hear that because she heartily agreed that I had very little to teach. I thought, okay, so so we agreed on that point at least. But kind of what I meant was that there isn't some agenda or plan that one has in mind or that one acquires from somewhere and then brings to bear in a teaching situation. It isn't really like that at all. One of my favorite Zen stories, of course, is where Master Baijiang announces to the assembly that in all of China there are no teachers of Chan, no teachers of Zen. And, whereas you could say, well, that's only one side. But it's a very important side. Dogen, of course, taught that in our human life or world, you only can see one side at a time. As he put it in his poetic way, when one side is bright, the other side is dark. And if you try to somehow have both, you will get into serious difficulty. In fact, only Buddhas see both sides. We sentient beings see one side at a time, and the other side we don't see. So this side of no teachers, I think, is pretty important for us. Because not only in the West, but I think maybe particularly in the West, or maybe particularly this time in history in the West, we tend to acquire things. Certainly and obviously material things, but also kind of mental equipment and structure and baggage. And if one spends maybe even, you know, not very much time thinking that one is a teacher, that can very rapidly turn into a thing. And this actually will impede the teaching itself. So in this, our human world, we have this capacity to, you might say, see in the dark. And usually people don't realize that without some, I don't know, cultivation or practice or something. We don't realize that we have what Dogen called nighttime eyes. All we know about is the daytime eyes. So, in our sitting practice, we simply allow the nighttime eyes to be open. We don't open them ourselves because they don't, what do I say, they don't operate at our command exactly. They operate according to what Chan calls the imperative. So in addition to acquiring baggage, such as, ooh, I'm a teacher, or even, ooh, I'm not a teacher, it's another kind, we also have some sense of the vastness of the universe, which is, as they say, is as pathless as the track of the birds through the sky. And since that can cause some difficulties of its own, we have some precepts which you might say project a kind of a map into this vast universe to help us a little bit with our behavior. Because otherwise, we might think, for instance, that anything goes. And whereas, in a way, it's true, the way anything goes is the way that the Buddhas demonstrate. And the way they demonstrate it, they do no harm. And in fact, their activities are for the sake of maturing beings, so that beings will come to appreciate their nighttime eyes. So any and all teaching is about that, should I say, something like that. Yeah, there's sometimes some more particular content, but mostly it's about this maturing beings, which really means encouraging them to practice in the dark, to let their nighttime eyes reveal the path, reveal the way. And that process of working in and amongst beings really is just another one of them. Is kind of intimate and exposes some, you know, very tender parts of our heart-mind, our body-mind. So one of the great errors there would be to, should I say, kind of presume upon that process, that relation. To avoid that, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, usually made a point of having someone ask him for some teaching. Most of the time, as you may notice, he didn't wander around, you know, ringing a bell in the town square and saying, "Okay, gather around, I got some teaching here." But usually he didn't teach at all unless someone asked. So this teaching thing is based on that request. And if that request is not present, then it is a terrible presumption to teach anyway. It will almost certainly do more harm than good. So the other day after our we have our weekly study hour, Thursday, and I made some remark in which I referred to my students. And I think maybe it was confusing to some folks, because it didn't occur to me to elaborate at the time what I meant by that. And really all I meant was those from whom that request had come in a fairly, maybe a little bit formal way, because I didn't dare presume upon that relationship. And therefore, I didn't dare presume to ask anything of anybody from whom that request hadn't come. So when I said something like, oh, let's see, any of my students here, I wasn't sorting the sheep from the goats, as they say in Christianity. I was just seeing, oh, who here have we had that conversation, if I had that conversation with. Because then I felt I could say something like, so if I croak, would you please go and see my teacher or my Dharma siblings and talk about your practice. That was really all I meant. So I wanted to clarify that a little bit and make sure nobody felt like I was, you know, excluding them from the inner circle, because there isn't one. You know, you're all in the inner circle. We're all in the inner circle. One of the great things about Chan is, or Zen, is that the supreme teaching is always presented to everyone all at once, right at the start. So the sometime upaya, the skillful means of presenting a graded series or like progression of teaching, it kind of unfolds that way, but that particular upaya is not characteristic of Zen so much. Zen tries to, it's like, well, let's chuck everything, hopefully not including the baby with the bathwater, and just, you know, start at the top. So practice as the Buddha's practice. Let's do that. And of course, for everyone, that involves some unfolding and some encounter with various states of mind and body and various ways the teaching is formulated and expressed. But generally, people who come for the 8:30 a.m. instruction, they get the whole enchilada right off the bat. And that's kind of cool in a way, because you're not really waiting for anything. Like when I was in high school, I was at a boarding school run by European Benedictine monks. They were an okay bunch of guys, most of them. But I felt like their view of spirituality, such as I knew of it, was rather limited. So I tried to become a Rosicrucian. As it happens, the Rosicrucian kind of headquarters is in San Jose, which wasn't too far from where I was living. And so I went and got their little marketing pamphlet, which is called The Mastery of Life, or it was in those days. And I thought, cool. And then, you know, it turns out that you kind of have to join, and you kind of have to pay a certain amount. And then you get these lessons about stuff like soul travel. I don't want to have to... First of all, I didn't have any money, so I didn't want to have to pay for anything. And I didn't see why... I didn't quite understand this business of lessons where they were going to ramp you up to some exalted level, and then I guess you were a Rosicrucian. So I kind of gave that up. And so that model is not the one that Zen has specialized in. It's my quiet joy to practice with all of you at the top of the mountain all the time. And when that so-called teaching thing happens, all it means is that the relation between two or more people is such that the current of Dharma is flowing. That's really all that means. And yeah, there's a little bit of, we say, you know, vertical and horizontal connection in the Sangha. There's a little bit of verticality there, but not so much. Mostly it's a kind of verticality that enhances and celebrates the vigor and warmth of the horizontality. That's really all that's necessary. Once in a while, maybe, you know, sometimes the teacher will come out with something rather sharp. But ideally, only out of love, not out of reproof, and certainly not out of disrespect. Mostly, I don't do that. When I was at the monastery there at Thanatasahara, once in a while I seemed to be inspired to present something in a rather sharp or forceful fashion. Mostly that didn't go over so well, because mostly Americans don't like that. They'd rather be talked to very nicely. And I noticed quite a few years ago that my teacher, who was also inclined to deliver things in a rather abrupt fashion, had started always asking somebody, like, would you mind a little feedback? And he never used to do that, you know? But then he started asking people because the results were better. You know? He checked it out with them first, like, how about some feedback? Is it okay? And they said, no, not today. Like, okay. So he'd go back later, you know, another day, and try it. Anyway, the heart of that should be love and respect and mutual appreciation of the gift of Dharma, which always flows back and forth from heart to heart. So I think that's about all I wanted to say, since we have other fun things to do today. But you might have some question or comment or complaint or objection. Yes, do you have an objection?
No, objection. No. Oh, okay. Maybe a comment or a share.
Yes, please.
Thank you for speaking on the subject. And I will learn from your example, because sometimes I feel like I'm in that murky area of what are we doing here? You know, as Zen, and this is a practice leader. I've had experience with somebody outside recently, maybe like a week ago, wanting to speak with someone, a priest, because there was a spiritual emergency.
And that was so, when I was really sick, right?
That's when you were extremely ill. Yeah. And so I said you were extremely ill. But I practiced with him, or I tried to just listen to what he had to say. And so, you know, I hope I led him right, that we weren't about, you know, I said, you're welcome to come on Saturday. We're all here. That's a good time if you want to practice. No, I don't want to practice.
Oh, he said that.
Yeah.
Oh, how interesting. Okay.
And I said, you know, and I can sense that his view of what a spiritual leader is, because he went on the website, maybe very, you know, parallel to what Christianity is and a priest is. And and I'm thinking, well, I'm glad Neil's not like that. In the sense that, you know, I'm not coming here following someone who's like the it person. It was difficult because, you know, he finally said he was disgusted. He was feeling this, he was feeling that. And I kind of made a distinction. Maybe it's not a spiritual thing he's going through. Maybe it's an emotional thing he's going through. And we're not necessarily, I don't think we're equipped to help somebody look like that. And I hope we're not. I hope none of us, you know, tries to help somebody who has an emotional crisis. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of us are really equipped for that. That's my personal view. So I think we're dealing with that. I also wonder, too, you know, you on being out, practice leader, and we had some charismatic practice leader here before who had passed on, and the memory of them are so strong that they're almost inhuman, you know, and you think, Mill's not like that. I'm like, well, they were not here to say, you know, I'm only human. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea, you know, is something I think sometimes I grapple with, mm-hmm. and I think I sense that other people grapple with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes you get that feeling around Zen Center, you know, around Suzuki Roshi, who I was privileged to meet and who was very human. But sometimes when you hear him spoken of, it's as though he weren't somehow. But it's interesting that that gentleman you are speaking of, he had encounters with all three of our residents in addition to you. So it's like at least four Sangha members he had some exchange with. And all four of you were trying to prevent him from, like, coming from banging on my door where I was paralyzed with a migraine. So I'm grateful. But there have been some other people who showed up in a state, you might say. And if I'd been well, I would have talked to him and seen what could be done. Something about the symbolic aspect of talking to a spiritual authority is important to people for reasons best known to themselves. And we can play that game a little bit. It's okay. My brother, who's a Catholic priest, gets that a lot. And sometimes people are really out there. I mean, way, way out there. And, you know, then he's quite good. He's a very, very pastoral priest, so he's quite good at kind of calming people down a little bit and trying to simplify the situation. And sometimes that's all that we can do, and sometimes that's all that's necessary. A few years ago, a woman came to the door here who was very upset. And it wasn't clear exactly about what, but she came in, and another Sangha member was here with me, and we just sat with her, had some tea. And after an hour or so, she was much better. She thanked us and went on her way. So we can do that too sometimes. Anyway, thank you for being part of that line of scrimmage there, sort of keeping this poor man from trying to drag me out of bed, which would not have been helpful, you know, to him. So, yes.
Thank you. Your line of thought led me. It's such a dumb question. I can't believe, but I can't figure it out. All right. Now you're going to ascend the mountain, city. How, if at all, will our relations with you be different?
I don't imagine they will be. It may be slightly different with some people who aren't here and who don't usually come here. That is, some people, there'll be some point where some of us in our funny clothes will be like walking around part of the block from our neighbor's house on the other side of the fence here around to Harford Street. So some people will see that, you know, and then they may say, well, what's going on over there? Some more Castro weirdness, you know. And so they may hear some story, and then that may change. But I don't imagine that anything much will change here. It's more about the face of the temple and letting people see that, boy, there's actually a temple here, and people practicing together, and a sangha that is alive, and it is the actual heart of this place, in addition to its historical significance. So that may change. But beyond that, my relations with people, I don't think will change.
Thank you, Neil. A little perplexed, though, in terms of in the tradition of my limited studies of Zen, is that there seems to be this teacher-student relationship, she said, where there's the request, and somehow there many of the stories pass on where, you know, in terms of the lineage, to say, aha, you know, you know, through various questions, I think you really understand the teachings, or maybe someone outside, you know, of the regular circle would come in and say, oh, the story is, you know, you understand more than the thing. You will be now the new
the
Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, mm-hmm. I pass on my lineage, you know, mm-hmm. teaching to you. So there does seem to be this very strong current mm-hmm. of aha, especially since Dogen, of aha, and now I pass it on to mm-hmm. the next.
But, are you done?
Yes. Yeah.
So, but what are they mostly saying? Most of those people who have been, for whatever reason, they're the it person of the day, whatever it is. What are they mostly saying? They're mostly saying, you know, in that in the Korean style, you know, when they have a Dharma dialogue ceremony, there's a ritual response after each questioner. Every question, the first thing that the responder says is, you already understand. They stick, say, you already understand. And then they maybe have some more dialogue. Mm-hmm. But this is basically what all those it people are saying, right? They're not saying, I'm going to tell you about it so you can understand. It's like, you already understand, right? This is the actual point of the teaching. And this is what I draw from virtually all of the Zen stories, even the ones that appear to be emphasizing hierarchical or vertical succession. It's all in service of ultimate horizontality. You know, this is, and it's pretty important, and this is why you want to watch that teaching thing, because otherwise something starts to get out of balance. And then you have stuff going on like went on at Zen Center in some years ago, mm-hmm. where because of our mutual immaturity, we started to let that happen. And it was okay with Suzuki Roshi, because he was a little 50-some-odd-year-old Japanese man who'd had a lot of training and was new to the West. And that we got away with it then. But then as soon as it became the responsibility of another Westerner, that problem began to grow. And the community could not mature without confronting and dealing with that, which was that big explosion that happened. So that big explosion was about deflating excessive verticality. And we had to do that. We had to go through that. So, fortunately, the teaching survived. Now there's a far more horizontal feeling. And, of course, for us, that too can become a problem. So one of the things that's a difficulty over there is that a certain amount of verticality starts to crop up, people like bash it down. Get on there. You're no better than us. You know, which is also kind of a funny thing. Uh-huh. Like sometimes the discomfort, the memory of the problem is still so sharp that people react very strongly. It's like, you know, let's take this person down a peg or two, you know, deflate that verticality over and over and over again. So that can become baggage too. Did you have a question?
I did. I mean, I guess I've been engaged in sort of a teacher-student relationship that feels somewhat formal
mm-hmm.
outside of Zen, more in a yoga situation.
Yeah.
I've sort of been sitting with the past almost a couple of years now. I always feel like I want more,
mm-hmm.
More teachings, more mm-hmm. something. And I never talk about it because I have always the question is, well, what is this more that I'm after? Like, can I sit with a simple offering for, you know, a few months? Can I practice that? Or, you know, it's just, do I have some notion of what a teaching is? And maybe when we're just, you know, sitting here watching kids run around, that's a teaching in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess because you brought it up today, and you, I loved the comments about the current of Dharma flowing and that being the relationship. I guess I was wondering if you could, I don't know, speak to a little bit this idea of wanting more teachings or
yeah.
more from a teacher. And
yeah. Well, you know, you're thirsty for Dharma, which is coming from your own, I'd say, Buddha nature. So there's nothing wrong with that. And I remember quite distinctly going to Katagiri Roshi, who at the time was helping out at San Francisco Zen Center, and saying exactly that, saying, I really feel like I want some more teaching, more instruction. And I thought, okay, this is cool. He's going to give me something. You know? And he said, perhaps you should try flower arranging. Flower arranging? But he was quite, he meant it, you know. It's like, oh, you want more stuff to do? Well, take up flower arranging, you know. That's a cool thing. As it happens, I took up tea ceremony instead. But that did satisfy some of that wanting to do something more with this body mind that felt like Dharma. By and by, I began to see that that was accessible all the time. You know, and it took a little while, but there's nothing wrong with the thirst for Dharma at all, as long as we don't assume that it's somewhere other than where we are. Even though that's the tendency, you know, we all have that tendency, but the teaching's pretty clear that that's not so. But maybe you can just, you say you haven't said to your teacher, I'd like a little more teaching, please.
I think it's because I have a feeling she's going to be like, go flower arranging. Yeah. I mean, seriously, you want more? Like, I can give you some more stuff. You want some more baggage? I mean,
Well, it might be worthy, just having that conversation might be really interesting. Yeah. Jen, did you want to say something?
Just a quick comment. Yeah. we were talking about the 80s and the Christ, or the immaturity of the community and the teacher dynamic, and that it's much better now. But what I always have felt, observing slightly from the outside, is one thing that's never really happened is forgiveness. It's a kind of forgiveness, and rather than keeping things apart, you know, just thanking and being grateful for what came before.
Yeah.
Maybe it has happened, but it doesn't.
Well, actually, it has to some degree. There are still a few parties who feel they were so badly injured that they are not there yet. But by and large, the feeling is much different than it was even 6 or 7 years ago. Much more, yeah. The person we're referring to has been back a few times now and has been warmly received. And so I think the feeling has changed quite a bit, and for him too, you know, because he was pretty injured there for a while. And so sometimes those processes take quite a while. Richard, did you want to say
something? Oh, yeah. Well, actually, that brings to mind what you were saying about the something about a healing process going on there. That's part of the learning.
Yeah.
And maybe the teaching is occurring and the learning is happening, only we're just not aware of it at the time. And then maybe some years later, perhaps it's a moment of reflection, you realize that you have learned a great deal. Mm-hmm. You just weren't aware of it until you were learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that the nice thing is that the nighttime eyes operate even if we're not imagining that's what's happening. Kato-san, would you like to say something?
Just a statement, and certainly feel free to comment on it, and maybe you know what I'm going to say even, but I've been through the process of the, you know, requesting teacher things, and, and overall I'm just kind of examining things, and I think I'm going to challenge that a little bit. I think words are kind of useless.
Did you say useless?
Useless in a lot of things in life, so... Mm-hmm. Sort of my statement, I guess, to you, or my feelings, I'll speak for myself, is that when someone shows up here, they're here for your teachings, and someone keeps showing up here over and over again, they're here for you to teach them.
Well, I think that's true, and I hope that they will feel invited into that process, although that may take a little while also, and that some idea I may have about teaching won't get in the way, and that I'll be able to trust the Dharma, trust the teaching enough to let it happen in whatever body it happens to take on, rather than single out somebody for the benefit of my insight. Well, I'm going to benefit you with my insight, whether you want it or not. Do you see what I'm saying? So I want to and make that process accessible as possible without getting tripped up by it. So it's a little tricky, I guess.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I think the formal request can be a trip up.
It can be. It can be a trip, too. It can. Mm-hmm. I think at its best, it occurs when it has already happened. And it's just a little, it's like a little, just a little ceremony to acknowledge what has happened. And mostly when someone asks me for the precepts, then we get into this little ceremonial relationship. And what I look for is that the time for the ceremony is when the precepts have already been transmitted. They're already alive in that person's life. The ceremony is merely saying that. So if that's not yet happening for the person, then I feel like, well, then you know, the ceremony's not going to make it happen. So I think I share your point of view by and large.
A very question on this ceremony have to happen at all?
Not necessarily, no. You know, some people are their lives. In fact, one person I'm working with, it's quite obvious that the precepts are alive and well in that person's life. But there's no particular, certainly no hurry about any ceremony. That may never happen. That's okay too. Yes.
It seems to me that in this discussion of the student teacher relationship, that there's a lot of emphasis put on the student's request, mm-hmm. and how that's honored and held horizontally or vertically. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also really important to acknowledge that from a teacher's perspective, for the teacher to offer that mm-hmm. involves a great deal of generosity mm-hmm. and openness.
Yeah.
To be able to hold someone else's question, and their spiritual question, their practice question, alongside the teacher's own practice. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's
right. A lot of space needs to be open for that to happen.
Yeah,
and included in that is generosity.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point. Yeah.
Kind of pick up a little bit what Peter was talking about. I think a lot of times people, especially in a small situation like this where there's not like hordes of people running around that know all the forms and procedures and the status quo and the way things used to be and the tradition and so on and so forth, that I think people maybe feel kind of like lost in that they don't know that they can make requests mm-hmm. or they don't, because it's like what Peter kind of said, there's not an offering. And I think from the standpoint of a teacher, to make the teaching available could potentially be like I'm tooting my own horn kind of thing.
Yeah.
Look what I've got, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, that should not be where that person is coming from. Otherwise, you know, it's like you say, it's like it'll all go wrong.
Yeah.
But I've wondered that a lot about how that dynamic works when people come and they really don't know what the scene is.
Yeah.
You know, how does it conveyed to people in a straightforward way, and yet a way that's kind of like not overwhelming mm-hmm. and not too precious?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm thinking back on my own experience, and for me, what made the difference was I did keep going back. you know, again and again to the practice environment. And for quite a long while, not much was offered. I mean, people were seemed to be pretty happy to answer questions. But beyond that, what made the kind of the opening of that whole practice heart possible was this going back again and again. And what prompted that, I don't know, frankly. As we were talking about at breakfast, whatever idea I had about practice when I first started sitting in Los Altos is long gone. What came to supplant that is very hard to say, except that something kept drawing me back again and again. And in that growing, I guess, trust or something, the teaching began to be a significant part of what I was experiencing. And I'm not really able to explain that process. But as they say in AA, keep coming back. It works. It does, actually. It's just that it doesn't work like you think it's going to work. That's really the kicker.
Good thing, too.
Good thing, too. Exactly, yeah. Well, we could talk all day, but we're going to talk most of the day anyway. So maybe we should try our next fun thing, which is the full moon ceremony, and you're all welcome to stay for that. And as we say, there's a fair amount of bowing involved, but if you don't feel up to doing prostrations, it's okay. In fact, I'm usually nowadays the cantor, and I find I can't bow a lot and chant or I faint, so I probably won't be doing all of the prostrations either. But, please stay if you like. And Monday's a holiday, so don't come to Zazen. That's all the announcements I have. Except, thank you very much. Oh, yes.
Council,
yes. I mentioned that, I think, a little earlier. So yeah, we'll have parish council at 12:30 with our great and good friend, Beata Chaplin from Santa Cruz, Zen Center. So please join us for that, too, if you wish. Thank you very much.